From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Election Day is just 3 weeks away, so we're spending a full hour with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh.
In the next 4 years, we're going to continue to strengthen Boston together because we need to make sure that Boston is for all of us.
We'll talk housing.
Developers are overwhelmingly building housing that is not affordable to most people in Boston.
Race.
75% of the new police officers hired are white. And 90% of the new firefighters hired are white. We need public servants who look like the people in the city of Boston.
And education.
This is a city that embraces every student, regardless of their racial, cultural, and linguistic identity.
What's your question for Marty Walsh? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's get right to it. Mayor Marty Walsh is with us today for the full hour. Tomorrow we'll have an hour with his challenger in the mayoral election, City Councilor Tito Jackson. We know you've got questions, so call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can send us a tweet at Radio Boston or watch us online on Facebook Live, facebook.com/Radio Boston. And Mayor Marty Walsh, as I said, is in the studio with us. It's good to see you again, Mayor.
It's nice to be here today.
Okay. So we're going to talk about three big issues over the course of the hour: education, race, and housing, Mr. Mayor. But first of all, I want to ask you about something that kind of links into all three of those things. And here it comes. Are you going to tell us about Boston's Amazon bid?
Amazon.
Yeah.
You know, the bid obviously will be going in tomorrow. We have it finalized. I just signed the letter today. The final letter that we did to Jeff Benzo, the CEO of the company. It's really focused around the main structure of our document is focused around one location, but it also has...
And what location is that?
And that's East Boston.
Okay, and East Boston.
And we have other locations in there. So we don't have much around incentives in there because we didn't have to. We talked about kind of where we are in Boston, quality of life. What we talked a lot of different things in the package, and we'll see what happens. I mean,
specifically where in East Boston?
I'll wait late to the bid to come out.
There's only one place. Just tomorrow. Okay. All right.
You know, not too far from the airport.
I got it. Okay.
I think I just broke some story.
Everyone,
I'm in trouble.
That.
I think I'm in
it's
trouble.
A spot.
Is Nicole
not,
looking back there
not
at me?
Not too far from the airport in East Boston.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, and I feel, you know, the thing about Amazon, we're talking about 50,000 jobs in roughly a 10 to 15 year period. Jobs of all different educational levels, which is economic levels. It's going to have some significant growth in a neighborhood. It's going to allow us to build housing. We launched a housing plan, and we'll get into it in a few minutes in the speech here, in the conversation, but we launched a housing plan in October of 2014 to create 53,000 units of new housing. So we have a plan for that. We have a plan for education. We have smart people here in our city. We're working on our high schools and redesigning our high schools in Boston so we can tie that right into the Amazon workforce. So there's a lot of good things.
Tax incentives of any kind?
No, we didn't put any tax incentives in this piece right now. I mean, some cities did. There was one in Massachusetts that put a $500 million incentive.
Worcester.
Yeah, it's too early in the process. You just don't know what exactly it is that you're building yet. You don't know what type of campus they want. The RFP was kind of open-ended, so we filled what we needed to, but we're not sure. So we'll get a chance now, if we get to the next round, to see what cities were chosen, what their bids were like, and to see really what we're up against.
Okay, so East Boston, this is really interesting because East Boston is already like a housing market that's changing tremendously.
Yeah,
right?
We've
got prices going up by double digits a year there. People feel like they're getting kicked out already because of rents going up.
But when you think Amazon, you're really in Boston. You have to think regionally. You can't think in an area of Boston. So let's hypothetically say for a moment we got chosen for the Amazon headquarters. the housing stock and the housing market is going to be feeded from all over Greater Boston. It's not all going to be within the city Boston limits. You just can't do it. I mean, it could happen, I suppose, but it's just not going to happen. So when we think about whether it's economic development-wise, it's regional. When we think about housing, it's regional. We have to start getting more regional when it comes to approaching on companies like Amazon and bringing other industry to our state.
Yeah, so the housing picture here is even more pressing because we've already got major housing needs, right? And so, as you said, even if it's localized or regional, nevertheless, I think if Amazon were to come, it would just amplify the need for affordable housing. And just give me a second here, Mr. Mayor, because just yesterday, actually, we spoke with a couple longtime journalists from Seattle in terms of how much the housing market has changed in Seattle in the past 7 years that Amazon's been undergoing some incredible growth. One of those folks is Joni Balter. She's a Seattle journalist, works for Bloomberg now. And here's what she said about housing and the effect of Amazon and other tech companies in Seattle.
Collectively, they are driving up prices so much. I mean, housing's like doubled almost. And the prices are too high and people are not able to afford it. So longtime Seattleites are being forced out.
So is there anything in the Boston bid for Amazon that sort of accounts for that? Well, and are you asking Amazon for anything to support Boston in building the housing?
I mean, again, we're in the very beginning stages. So we're just at the – we're in the first – if it's a baseball analogy, we're in the first inning. And the first step is to put in the bid in the documents, which we did today. And you know, in 2014, let me take these off for a second. Okay. In 2014, we responded to a housing shortage. One of the things that we realized in our city is that we were having people moving into our city, and we didn't have the ability to we didn't have the housing that was needed. We launched a plan in 2014. In that plan, it was to create 53,000 units of new housing. This is all income levels all across the board. Part of it was college housing, on-campus housing to free up housing stock in neighborhoods. Part of it was senior housing. Part of it was low-income housing. Part of it was workforce housing. So in response to that plan, since 2014, we have 22,000 units of housing that's been permitted in the city of Boston. Of those 22,000, 9,000 are moderate low-income units. What do I mean by that? People who are in between zero and, say, $120,000 per family, and which is the middle class. So we've never built that much housing. The issue that's happening at the same time is even though we're building all this housing, our population has grown by about over 30,000 people in the last 3 years. So as quickly as we're building this housing,
you need even more
people are coming in. So what we really have to do is think about, and we've been talking this, is trying to increase housing productions, but also looking at areas of the city of Boston to rezone. So that's where the growth zone idea came out of. We looked at Jamaica Plain, and we looked at South Boston. We're looking at Dorchester now, and looking at an area that we could potentially use for mixed-use, multi-use property, some jobs, some manufacturing possibly, economic development jobs, but also housing incorporated and sprinkled into that mix and looking at different areas. In our Imagine Boston 2030 plan, we look at areas like the Fairmont Line and opportunities for Fairmont for housing stock, but also economic growth. And how do you mix use these areas where you have good public transportation? Mm-hmm. And that's really what we need. So what Seattle came across was Amazon came, they loved it, but it became a city dominated by Amazon. Boston, if Amazon decides to come here tomorrow, we're not going to be a city dominated by Amazon. We have so many other businesses and so many other opportunities in our city of Boston. You know, our workforce has grown in Boston in the last 3.5 years by 60,000 jobs of all kinds of different.
Yeah, no, I mean, I get your point. Like, we've already got a great diverse base here, but Amazon would have an enormous footprint.
It would, but you're talking 15 years for it to come in, too. It's not going to happen overnight, and it's a slow build-up, and it's a slow process getting to that point. It's not like they're going to say, okay, we're going to come to a city, and in the next day, 50,000 cars are pulling up down the street.
Right.
It's not going to be the case.
I'm going to ask you to put those back on, because I want you to hear this caller who's just called in. Julia is calling from East Boston. You're on the air, Julia.
Hi, Mayor Walsh. How are you?
Good, Julia. How are you?
Good. Thanks for taking my call. Just real quick, I'm assuming that you're alluding to the Suffolk downsite for Amazon, which is actually an exciting prospect for me personally as an Eastie resident. Much better than a casino, in my opinion. So that's my first comment.
Better jobs in some ways.
She's assuming, meaning she's right? The mayor just winked.
Go ahead.
No, I was.
No,
we're
something
just,
in my eyes.
We're just fact-checking. The mayor just winked when we said, assuming it's Suffolk Downs. He winked.
Yeah, I'm speculating here. Mayor Walsh, I've been a resident at EC for about 12 years now, and myself and many of the community members are concerned by the lack of a master plan for East Boston and the overwhelming amount of development that we seem to be inundated with. Specifically, our community is concerned with a project in Maverick Square, which is one of the, you know, prominent areas of East Boston. The project intends to demolish two historic row houses, relocate a landmark clock, all to be replaced by a two-story subpar.
Julia, I'm sorry to jump in here, Julia, but I want to be able to get to as many people as I can this hour. So can you just ask the mayor the question that you've got?
Sure. Sorry for all the details. I just want to know where the mayor stands with the community in terms of historic preservation and a master plan for smart urban planning and development in, you know, our community across the harbor.
Well, I think that, thank you for your question. I mean, I think that the changes we have made at the Boston Planning and Development Agency has been about smart urban planning and growth in a community, also preservation of a community. I fought to make sure that the Community Preservation Act passed in 2016, and part of that is a fund that would go to historic preservation in the city of Boston. We haven't had a fund in the past that would help keep some of our historic sites in the city of Boston. So I think that the East is going through a very interesting time. When I was running for mayor 4 years ago, people in East Boston were concerned because it hadn't taken off, and people weren't. A lot of these proposals were on the table, but they didn't quite start. 4 years later, East is one of the hottest areas in the city of Boston, and people are saying, you know, we want to slow down development, and we're starting to take a look at some of the proposals in the community. People want to be in East Boston. People are moving into East Boston from all over, and for years in the past, and people are moving out, and East Boston's not the only community to understand that or see that feel. It's happening in Dorchester, it's happening in Mattapan, it's happening in Roxbury, it's happening throughout this entire city.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you something a little bit more about affordability and all the housing that you have built so far. Because as you said a little bit earlier, you're really looking at especially incomes between zero and $125,000 a year. And you know that people, when they hear that range, a lot of folks say, well, we can't say that a household earning $125,000 needs, quote unquote, affordable or low income housing. And to that point, I'd like to actually play a piece of tape from October 11th at the MPDC debate that you and Councillor Jackson engaged in, the Rocks Vote Coalition, because he talked about, if he were to be mayor, Councillor Jackson did, about what his plan would be for affordable housing. And here's what Tito Jackson said.
In my administration, we will have 25% affordable housing requirement if you build over 10 units. And if you build on land that is owned by the city, public land should be used for public good. And so you will be required to build one-third low income, one-third market, and one-third middle income to ensure that everyone has an opportunity.
What do you think of the plan, Mayor?
First of all, public land for private use is difficult to do. What we've been doing under the last 3 years here with Department of Neighborhood Development has used public land for first-time home buyer programs. Building first-time home buyers homes for first-time home buyers. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. We've been able to build, I think, 250 of them. We have more coming. I think if we use public lands to build housing, we should be using it to build workforce housing, low-income housing, and possibly some artist housing as well around the city. That's what we're looking to do. And some of the money from the inclusionary development, which we raised to 18%, we were able to get some significant money from that, as well as the Community Preservation Act for next year. So we've made those investments. The 25% affordable on a 10-unit house is not going to work. People aren't going to build a house. They're not going to build a property. And I think that we're up to 18% offsite.
They're
now.
Not going to build it because they can't recoup their costs.
It's not affordable. You're not going to be able to do it
for the developers.
No city or town has 25%. I think at one point Cambridge went to 20. I think they reduced the number down. You need to. Some of the high end housing that we're building in Boston is actually paying for low end housing. We've been able to recoup $57 million last year from inclusionary development because we made the change from 13 to 18%. Once that high-end housing stops being built, we're not getting money to build low-income housing. So we need to continue to build, you know, in the inclusionary development money, The Community Preservation Act money that we're getting is great. We're supposed to get a dollar-for-dollar match from the state, but it's 17 cents on the dollar now. Mm-hmm. So we're not getting that dollar-for-dollar.
Well, what about Councillor Jackson's other proposal that he's made a couple of times in the course of this campaign season about redefining what affordable means? I mean, I know right now the city uses guidelines put out by HUD, for example, but Councillor Jackson has said that he wants affordability to be based on what the median income in a particular neighborhood is,
not all over Boston,
because we've got such... inequality in Boston. The median may seem artificially high.
I think when you look at families in the city of Boston, you mentioned earlier when I talked about a family earning $120,000 a year. In some ways, that's an awful hard to raise a family.
It's a lot of money,
depending on the kids, and in some cases, not a lot of money, depending on the rent, depending on the mortgage you have, and the repairs your house needs. I think that as far as redefining, I mean, we have a pretty good definition of what low income is in the city of Boston, and we have a pretty good definition of what median income is in the city of Boston. We do use the HUD guidelines for some of that, for some of the housing issues. But I mean, I think when we think about the city, we shouldn't be building all of our low income housing either in areas that would be so-called labeled low income. I think we have to look at diversifying that across the board, giving people opportunities to live in different neighborhoods. I don't know if the council's proposal would work. I mean, I think that, you know, he started talking about this in the last 6 months, so I guess I'd have to look into it more.
I want to dig into a couple little details here because we shouldn't be building all the low-income housing in neighborhoods we currently would define as
neighborhoods
low-income.
Neighborhoods don't want it.
But of the thousands of units that you said you've already built,
yep.
True, we were looking at the numbers. Only 350 of the units were constructed or approved in, say, Mattapan. I mean, don't they need more housing as much
no,
as
they do,
else?
But I think in a lot of cases we have CDCs that are there trying to build low-income housing. And you know, we feel I see at the community meetings where people push back on it. A lot of them want workforce housing and they want opportunities for employment in neighborhoods. I'm not saying that we don't want to. We shouldn't build there, but I think that you don't want to continue to. Mattapan's probably a bad example. Mattapan has high home ownership properties there. A lot of, I think it's 80% of the people that live in the neighborhood own their own home.
Okay, so what about this, though? I mean, about how we define median income. And because Boston does have such wide extremes, I mean, I think it's worth kind of going through the numbers a bit. Some of the HUD numbers for a four-person household for Boston, area median income, they say is $103,000, right? But we were looking at some area median incomes for neighborhoods in particular, and this is from the American Community Survey. Charlestown, $83,000.
Back, this is family of four?
Yes, I believe. Alston Brighton, $52,000. Dorchester, $45,000. Roxbury, $30,000.
And this is the median family income.
This is area median income for neighborhoods.
And the housing stock in those last three areas, Brighton, Dorchester, and Roxbury, are all going up. And it's about creating an opportunity to put more supply on the market. And what we have in a lot of neighborhoods is people fighting housing. And we have, again, a perfect storm where we have millennials that want to stay in the city of Boston that are going to school here, and we have baby boomers wanting to move back. We're building housing, but not to the rate that it needs to keep up with the population increase.
Yeah.
We're heading towards, we thought, when we launched this housing plan, we thought we'd have 700,000 people living in Boston by the year 2030. We're probably going to have 700,000 people in Boston by the year 2020.
Hmm.
Now, the reason why I bring that up, and not to switch subjects on the median prices, is that we need to build more to bring the demand down.
Yeah.
So we need to put more supply on the market so that we can stay. We saw last year a stabilization in rents in 4% in certain parts of the city of Boston. But again, that's because we put a lot of supply on the market, but that supply is going quickly.
You know, as you probably know, WBUR, we released a poll earlier this month, and 76% of the folks that we polled are either dissatisfied or somewhat dissatisfied with the cost of housing. So it's the number one issue in the city.
It's the number one issue in the country, too, by the way. When you go to urban America and you look at cities around America, people are moving back into the cities at record numbers. They're moving, in the 80s, it was a flight to the suburbs.
Yeah.
And now in 2017, it's a flight back into the cities.
Yeah. Well, let's take another call here. Nicolasa is calling from Quincy. She's on the air. You're on the air, Nicolasa.
Hi. Thank you so much for the opportunity. Mayor, I have lived in the city of Boston for almost 30 years, 27 years to be exact. And because housing is so high, the rent is so high, I couldn't find two-bedroom for $2,000 apartment so I can move in. So now I have to be relocated to Quincy. And I hear you talking about that this is an issue that's going around the country. But what about the people that have been living in Boston for so long and now need to move out of the city? And because I work for the city, then my job is in jeopardy now. So what do you tell me about that?
Well, if you're working for the city of Boston and you live in Quincy, and unless you have worked for the city for 10 years, you can't do that. I mean, if you're covered by a union, but forget that for a minute.
Well, actually, I think she told our producer, Nicholas, are you still there? Because I think you work for Boston Public Schools?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. One of the issues, again, it goes back to in 2014, we took office and quickly found out that we had a housing shortage in the city of Boston. We should have had a plan, a more accurate plan, to build more housing to understand the influx of people coming to the city of Boston. We launched that plan in October of 2014, 9 months after I became mayor of the city of Boston, and we've been producing a lot of housing in the city, almost 10,000 units of moderate low-income housing, and some of it's high-end housing, and we're continuing that process right now as we talk. I mean, we approve projects every month, and we're constantly approving opportunities to build more housing, and Boston is one of the hottest cities in America where people want to live in. And again, I mean, it's important that we continue to build this housing to keep up with the demand that we have in the communities. And you, unfortunately, are one of the folks that I'm not sure what neighborhood you lived in. But
Dorchester, she said.
That story is happening all over the place. I mean, I grew up on Taft Street in Dorchester. I talk about the story all the time. And I have all three families on my street that I grew up with. My mother still lives there. And I'm watching these houses one at a time turn around to condominiums. And I'm watching these young people come in and buy them where, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, 30 years ago, people were buying three families to help pay for the mortgage of the house. Mm. Now we're breaking them into condos, and it's driving the cost up. I mean, it's not my place to say if it's right or wrong that it's happening, but it is my place as mayor to try and create more opportunities to keep people in the city and also to keep up with the growth of our city.
Is there anything that the city can do to bring the cost of the development or the cost of the building the new housing down?
That's not an issue right now, though. I mean, that hasn't been the issue. I think that in some cases, depending on where they're being built, I mean, if we're trying to use city-owned land to bring the cost down, we're obviously using IDP, Inclusionary Development Money, and we're going to be using Community Preservation Act money pretty soon to build more housing. We have the Office of Housing Displacement, Housing Stability, that we've been able to keep 1,000 people in their home that were being displaced. Mm-hmm. We filed legislation at the State House to keep people in their home that if a bank for – now, there's not as many foreclosures in Boston as people would think. But we're trying to keep people – there's a foreclosure that we keep the tenants in the house. Our home buying program, 60% of the folks that have used our home buying program and worked to get mortgages through have been people of color. Yeah, 10% of the people out of the private banks are people of color last year. So there's some issues there around lending as well. So we have to work on those.
I mean,
that's access to capital. So there's a whole host of issues that we're working on all different fronts to tackle the issue of housing. So it's not as simple. I mean, somebody come in here tomorrow and talk about, I would do this 25% affordable. We're raising money from inclusionary development. We're raising $57 million. A third in private property. We're building housing on private property for first-time home buyer programs.
Yeah.
Those are all programs that we're doing today.
I gotcha. We're going to take a quick break here. We're speaking with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. He's with us for the whole hour, and we could talk about housing for the whole hour, but there's lots of other issues to tackle. Race, policing, and education are the ones that we're going to take a close look at. And by the way, the mayor said at the top of the hour that when he submits the city's bid for Amazon tomorrow, East Boston and Suffolk Downs are going to be the spot that he's putting forward for Boston for Amazon's consideration. And by the way, Mr. Mayor, one quick question. Since the Amazon bid is due tomorrow, will you make the whole thing public after that?
Yeah, I believe it's going to. At some point, it's going to be public.
Some point?
Yeah, like in the near future.
Like October 20th? 21st?
I'm not sure the exact date. But when we come back from break, I'll have the answer.
Okay, great. All right. So 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK to get your question to Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. We'll be back in 60 seconds. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is with us for the full hour. Tomorrow we'll be talking to City Councilor Tito Jackson, as there is just 3 weeks left until Election Day, and Boston has a chance to choose whether or not it wants to re-elect Mayor Marty Walsh or turn to Councilor Jackson for new mayoral leadership in the city. Call us right now at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK if you want to ask a question of Mayor Marty Walsh. And let's talk a little bit about...
Before we do, Amazon bid Friday.
You're going to make it public on Friday?
Public Friday.
Okay. Set it on the record, folks.
Call City Hall on Friday.
I'll wait for the email from your office to bid.
So we put online.
Okay. But I'll put online Friday.
Yeah.
Terrific. All right. So let's talk about race and policing in Boston. Also a very important issue because obviously the city itself is majority minority. And I mentioned that a WBUR poll from October in the previous segment. In that same poll, we found that 54% of potential Boston voters were dissatisfied with the state of race relations in the city. 41% said they were satisfied. Yeah. So pretty split. But I mean, even the fact that there's 54% of folks who are dissatisfied with race relations, does that concern you?
Yeah. Systemic racism is a problem in our city, and it's a problem in America. And it's an issue that we have continually dealt with and worked on for 4 years as an administration. It's one of the first issues that I tackled as mayor. We had a town hall conversation on race, the first time a mayor in Boston's ever done that. You know, when I was a candidate for mayor in 2013, I was at a town hall meeting and a woman questioned me on race, the state of race in Boston. And I answered the question in a way that didn't satisfy her and that got me concerned that I didn't have a really full understanding or an answer to talk about race and racism in Boston. So we went back as a campaign and we came up with some platforms and talked about that we were going to deal with, and when I say deal with, talk about race and finally tackle the issue of race and racism, which in some ways is very two different issues combined to be together. So we started by hiring a resiliency officer, mm-hmm. Dr. Tia Martin. We applied for the Rockefeller 100 Resilient Cities. We got awarded a grant.
You know, your opponent says that's he doesn't feel that it's meaningful enough because it's not really funded well enough.
That's okay. He can say what he wants. We've been working on this issue for a long time, and we're also working.
But I mean, do you disagree with him? Do you think it has adequate funding?
I completely disagree with him. And he's had an opportunity as city council for the last 4 years to honestly, if he felt it wasn't adequately funded, why didn't he bring it up in the budget in 2014, which he voted for, or the budget in 2015, which he voted for, or 2016 or 2017? He didn't vote for those two. I mean, there's plenty of opportunity during his career to bring up these issues. And for the last 4 years, we've talked about these issues. And the last 4 years, we've been involved with my brother's keeper. My opponent also hit me saying that I vetoed a program for black and brown boys that he passed to the council. The reason why we didn't move forward, first of all, we didn't move forward with that because we had my brother's keeper that President Obama asked Boston to be part of, and which we did. And then when the council got the commission on black and brown boys, he held one hearing. So let's talk about the hearing. If you're going to have a commission, how come you only hold one hearing? So I think there's more work to be done. So to go back to the race.
The knives are starting to come out between
the
two
of
you. No,
I'm going to keep it off there. That's all. I'm done there talking bad now. So we had when we started the 100 Resilient Cities, we've been having dialogues around the city of Boston, and we're in the process right now. We work at the Himes Foundation. They awarded us some more money to be able to continue to do facilitated training to have race dialogues around the city of Boston. So that's one piece we're working on. The second piece is obviously we had the issues around Latin School last year, which were concerning, and 2 years ago, I should say now. And you know, last year at the school, the kids were remarkable in really talking about and dealing with the issues around race in that school. And then we're able to hire the first person of color ever to run Latin School, Rachel Scarrett, which is going to start in a couple weeks here. So our three exam schools are run by people of color.
Mm-hmm.
The diversity of the city, of the departments and the police department, those are all important aspects as well that we need to.
Yeah.
To work on, you know, the command staff, the police department.
Yeah. But so let me just jump in there right there on that point, because again, at the Roxbury debate, and I mean it's out there because the two of you did meet and sat side by side to this point about the diversity of the city and employees who are representing the city. Councillor Jackson said he had an issue with what he believes is a lack of diversity, and he said it's one of the reasons why he's running. And here's what he said at the debate.
75% of the new police officers hired are white. And 90% of the new firefighters hired are white. We need public servants who look like the people in the city of Boston.
Again, unfortunately, those numbers are just wrong. In the class that's in right now, we have 160 officers still in the class of recruits, and roughly almost 50% of those are officers of color that are in the new cadet class, the new police class that's in being trained right now.
Being trained
right
now.
That's going to graduate in 20 weeks. We started the cadet program, which 69% or 70% of those young people that are in that program are people of color. We're working to the command staff at the police department. When I started as mayor, before I was mayor, it wasn't 50% people of color in the command staff. And we reached that goal. And you know, that goal is fluctuating a little bit because we've had a couple of retirements. So we have a few appointments to do there. But we're constantly working to make sure that that happens. We hired the first captain, Muslim captain, to run a district, Captain Hussein in B3. Mm-hmm. We have a Latino officer in Jamaica Plain.
These are all laudable things. But on the other hand, Mr. Mayor, hang on a second. On the other hand, you know that when you have an incident like when Boston police officer Joseph DeAngelo was put on leave because he had made this viral video that featured another BPD officer, and they had a tagline in the video saying, quote, "This summer, black people have met their match." He was put on leave, not fired. Yep. And that, like, that also resonates in the community, saying, why did Mayor Marty Walsh not fire Officer DeAngelo?
Commissioner Evans met with clergy, met with community leaders, and in having this investigation of this incident, came up with, and the NAACP was at the table, and the Urban League was at the table, came up with the understanding of using this as a learning experience, and they, with Commissioner Evans, along with the community, came up with the punishment for this particular case. And again, I think that wasn't talked about the other night, and that's something that's, you know, making sure that there's an understanding and a dialogue in a community. And what Officer DeAngelo has done since then is sitting down with different organizations, different groups of people to talk about his wrong. And I think that the fact that some of these instances you take is an opportunity for learning.
Well, so is that an opportunity also for deeper learning across BPD?
Absolutely. And we've done it. You know, Lisa Holmes has done it as the head of the trainer at the academy, superintendent of training. I mean, she's taken the way we train officers and changed it around racial training, racial bias, working with homelessness and addiction and young people. So she's completely changed the mindset of the way she trains her police officers. And I think that, you know, I think that people always pick to the side of the police that the wrong stuff. But there's a lot of good things happening in our city with our police department. You know, our arrests are down by 44%. A lot of that is working with the community, building relationships, building trust. You know, if you did a poll tomorrow and talked about the popularity of the police department and Commissioner Evans inside the communities of Roxbury, Dorset, Mattapan, I'd be willing to bet the numbers are off the chart.
Let's take a call. Sarah's calling from Jamaica Plain. You're on the air, Sarah.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. And thank you, Marty Walsh, Mayor Walsh, for taking my call. So I'm calling, I've been a resident of both Roslindale and Jamaica Plain, and I'm calling specifically about the way that police officers have responded in my community of Jamaica Plain that borders on Mission Hill in particular. And when police officers not only have taken hours to respond to a break-in and entering or a car that's been broken into, they will often respond that, you know, this kind of stuff just happens because I live in an unsafe area. And so that, as a resident, I find particularly discerning coming from police officers. So I'm curious as to what your response is and possibly what your administration is doing as to community policing and building better relationships with your residents rather than a sort of a...
So it looks like we lost Sarah's call.
Question to Sarah would be, did she experience this herself? Or is this hearsay? I mean, certainly that bothers me. The majority of the police officers that work for the police department are very vested in their community, in the areas that they work in. And I think that hearing something like that bothers me, that a police officer would make an assumption, something to that effect, that you live in a dangerous neighborhood. Roslindale, Jamaica Plain, from what I understand, I mean, I don't see it as a high crime ridden community that's out there. And I certainly don't see any police officer saying in any neighborhood in the city of Boston, nor would I hope they'd ever say that they live in a high high crime area. I think that if there's issues out there, certainly one thing that the police department does very well through community policing is accessibility through the civic associations and through the communities. Any event I've been to in Jamaica Plain or Rossendale, the police are there. And if there's an issue out there with response times and things like that, I would expect people to go to the police officers and say to them, you know, how come, what's going on with your response times? I mean, I was at a meeting the other night, the Wharf District Council, which is was in downtown, the Harbor District, down by the Rose Wharf area. And the people down there were asking for walking beats. And quite honestly, I said, you know, at the time that the community, the crime in the area doesn't warrant walking beats. But certainly I would love to see more walking beats in certain parts of Dorchester, Mattapan, and Roxbury, where people like Bowdoin, Geneva, where I used to represent as a state rep or adjacent to it. People up there want to see a walking beat. And over the last couple of years, we've had walking beats up there, and we've seen a homicide rate go from 4, 5, or 6 a year to 0.
Yeah.
And it's about how do you use the resources properly. I think what she was, Sarah might have been talking about too, that a lot of the resources might be in the Mission Hill area and not in Jamaica Plain. I think that there's a happy medium there that you have to work in to make sure both neighborhoods are paid attention.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know if she knows exactly where BPD can or should be putting its resources, but she was saying that when people call stuff in.
Yeah, but that's kind of a broad statement. I want to ask, did she hear that herself? And Sarah, I'd appreciate if you would call my City Hall office.
Actually, I think we still have her. Sarah, if your cell line's holding, you heard what the mayor's question?
Yeah, no, I definitely did. And I appreciate that. I've actually called these in myself at different points. And the two in particular that I'm thinking about are two cars that were broken into on my street, which are actually particularly close to, which border on a school. And I believe, while this is, you know, an assumption on my part, that the call was made because I lived close to a low-income housing, you know, which has been a larger discussion in this segment.
But just to be clear, Sarah, when you made those calls, the dispatcher or the police officer who answered your call said you kind of have to just live with it because you live in an unsafe area?
No, it was actually the police officer that responded.
That responded.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I'd like, Sarah, if you don't mind, if you would stay on the line and let the engineer here get your number, because I'd love to talk to you about that situation offline, because that is not what I hear on an ordinary day. I don't hear that every day. I think that the response times to a car break-in might be slow. I mean, I'll be honest with you, that's not the top priority for the city, for the police department, but it still should be a response and it should be a contact with the police department. But I'd love to talk to you more specifically on this to see if there's something that needs to be done.
Okay,
there.
Sarah, thank you for your call. We'll hand you back to our producer to get your number for Mayor Walsh. But since we're on this issue of policing, Mr. Mayor, we have another question that came through online from Alex, who asks, why haven't you responded yet to the policing questionnaire put out by the ACLU, Digital Fourth, and other civil liberties organizations?
I have no idea. I'll have to check and see.
Your campaign manager sent a letter back to the ACLU saying that you wouldn't respond.
Oh, I don't even know. I don't even know about that.
Okay.
It might have been based on, and let me think, are we taking another break here?
We're going to take a break in about a minute.
I'll find out after that, and I'll comment after the break.
Okay, so let's take that break now so you can find that out. 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're talking to Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. She's going to spend the rest of the hour with us. Give us a call with your question. 800-423-TALK. I'm Meghna Chakraborty. This is Radio Boston. We're back. I'm Meghna Chakraborty. This is Radio Boston. We're spending the hour with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. 800-423-8255 is the number to call. Tomorrow we will be hearing for an hour from City Councilor Tito Jackson as well. So before the break, Mr. Mayor, you were saying that you were finding out why it is and your campaign didn't answer the ACLU's questionnaire.
Part of it was the questions were slanted all towards our policies, what we're doing in the City of Boston.
We're
working on all the issues. We're working on the co-op board. We're working on the body camera issue. And we're working on a whole bunch of different issues.
Some of them are yes-no questions. I've got some of them right here in front of me.
Do
you want to answer them?
No, I'm not going to answer right now.
Why not?
Because there's other questions we didn't do.
But why? I mean, but it's just they're yes no questions about policing.
Give it to me.
Okay, I'll give you these are they're not hard. If reelected mayor of Boston, will you prevent the Boston Police Department from obtaining military weaponry such as machine guns, armored vehicles, drones, bayonets, or grenade launchers from the U.S. military?
Yeah,
yes or no?
We've been very clear on that all along. I actually made a public statement against that, and I thought that I criticized other police departments around the country for doing that.
Okay, if elected or in your case reelected mayor of Boston, will you enact a policy requiring independent, impartial investigations whenever the BPD uses deadly force?
we pretty much have that now. We have, there's an investigation if that happens, and then the district attorney takes over.
Okay, so here's the co-op one. If reelected mayor of Boston, will you support replacing the co-op with an independent community-based complaint review board with the power to subpoena, investigate, discipline, and fire police officers?
What we've done is we've strengthened the co-op board to add the members from 3 to 5. This is a recommendation from the co-op board, and we've increased their cases from up to 20% that they're going to review. And when you look at the police the complaints in the police department against police officers is down from 361 to 199. Excessive force complaints are down from 40 to 18 over the last 5 years.
If reelected mayor of Boston, will you actively support the repeal of all drug mandatory minimums this legislative session?
I'm in the process of working. I have to look at all the bills they're talking about. But when I was a state rep, most of the bills to reduce mandatory minimums were mine.
Okay. So that's some of the questions, not all of them. There were some more sort of essay-type questions as well, which I'm sure the ACLU and other advocates would love if you actually did respond to. But we've got about 9 minutes left, and we got to talk about schools because a huge issue in the city of Boston. So let's go straight to a caller who's got a question about that. Martise is calling from Hyde Park. You're on the air, Martise.
Hi, I'm Martise from Hyde Park. I've been a resident in Hyde Park for 13 years, and I was a BPS parent for 6 of those years. And my question to the mayor is basically, what are some of the improvements in terms of academics and also enrichment that he would make to the BPS system? Because what I found is that in the particular school where we were at, as the kids were moving up in grades, a lot of parents were, you know, pulling the kids out, either choosing the independent school route, parochial, or other, options.
Martise, I'm just going to just take it back from... I'm so sorry to interrupt you, Martise, but we don't have that much time left, and I just want to give the mayor a chance to respond to your question.
Let me just start by saying, in 2013, we had one of the shortest school days in the country. In 2017, we don't, no longer. All of our kids in grammar schools are getting about 120 hours more a year of instruction in the classrooms. So I think that's an important piece. We have 46 schools that are high-performing schools in the city, that highest performing in the Commonwealth. We're working on, we've identified, I think, about 16 or 17 level 3 schools that we've increased funding to this year through the budget, I think $16 million, and we're going to continue to make those investments. Those are schools that if you go to level 4, you get additional funding. If you stay at level 3, you're in that kind of area of either improving with what you have or getting worse. So we're making investments there. We've increased the school budget in the last 4 years by $154 million, even though I get criticized for cutting budgets, which we haven't. We inherited a structural deficit inside the school department, which we're working through. We've also worked on increasing special education funding by 21% in the city of Boston over the last 3 years. And we're working on a program called Build BPS, which is going to make $1 billion investments in our schools. Two-thirds of our schools were built before World War II or during World War II. So we have some structural issues that we're working in our schools. And I would say that, you know, I would say that in a lot of different areas, we've created a program, Tommy Chang, Excellence for All, which is a program of increasing the curriculum across all school districts. Yeah. We have a program, fifth quarter this year, with 6,000 kids did an after-school program, not after-school, summer school program, where they were able to be part of sports and be active, but also be part of learning.
So a lot of programs. New programs. Okay, but just to go back to the budget question a little bit, because it's a point of contention, obviously, in this race. And honestly, it's a point of contention every year with BPS. So, like, help me understand something, because we were looking at numbers from BPS itself, general fund totals for the 125 schools. And according to our analysis, 53 of the 125 schools in the city had negative change in their budgets from 2017 to 2018.
Because they had no change in their enrollments.
No change in so their overall budgets
go
down?
For the most part, the money follows the kid. So when schools when kids leave schools and go to other schools, the money, for the most part, follows the kid to the school. So when you think about schools, I mean, we're not going to continue to, if a school loses 30 kids, we're not going to continue to give them the money when they don't have kids in the classroom.
So it's an enrollment change.
It's an enrollment change. And this all happened 2012, 2013, where the city made the changing. This is goes with the autonomous of a school to allow principals to make decisions on hiring. So what we did in the principal stuff and on the teacher stuff is move the hiring up to April. So as school budgets are being put together, teachers are able to plan out out their year better. And when they have additional kids coming into the school, they have to make preparations. And when they, quite honestly, they make the decision on whether to lay teachers off or not when they have under enrollment.
Okay. So is that what explains the 12% cut to Brighton High, for example?
I mean, that would be part of it. But Brighton High went to level four, so this year they got additional money now.
Oh, okay. Now, on Monday, you said you had, speaking of high schools, that you had real concerns about the city's high schools.
Yeah, you know, when I say this, I was asked a question at the Globe Editorial Board about what areas of schools am I concerned most about that. You know, we've talked about the gains we made, and I talked about the level one and level two schools. I talked about all of the great things happening in our schools. And I said, the high schools, they concern me in a lot of ways. We have a 72% graduation rate, which is the highest in the history of the city. We've been able to increase that graduation rate by 6 points over the last 3 years. But we still have 27% of our kids not graduating high school. That number scares me when I think about that. The amount of kids that we're putting out in the street that aren't graduating high school, they're dropping out or leaving, and they don't have an education behind them. And there's very few options for them to turn to.
Now, BPS represents 35% of the city's budget. Just about.
Yeah, right about that.
Yeah.
Which is the largest chunk.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's $1.093 billion this year.
And state spending, though, for Boston Public Schools
has gone down.
Or at least flatlined.
It's gone down. And the
charter school reimbursement.
Both lines have gone down.
And have gone down. So, I mean, how long is, so are the public, are Boston's public schools adequately funded, and can the city keep making difference?
I think right now the city's making up the difference. So we're funding them where they need to be funded, and we're making the changes that need to be made, and we're making the investments that need to be made. But what's happening every year is getting more and more difficult because something on the city side is going to lose out. And you're going to lose out. So as we have this time of year, these last 3 years, it's been great. We have great revenue coming in, and we have great growth in the city. But let's assume over the course of the next 5 years that growth stops or slows down. That will start to take away a road from city programs because you have to continue fund education. I mean, you can't cut back on education. You can't lay people off. Education is the lifeline of the city of Boston in a lot of ways as far as preparing and educating our young people for the future. So when we think about that, I would love to have the $25 million investment we made up to close the gap on charter schools. I'd love to make that investment in a different part of the school system if we could. The money that we're trying to adjust on transportation, I would love to, that money, if we can save money on transportation, that's not going to be a savings that's going to come into the general fund. Mm. That's going to be reinvested in the school. So, you know, and what I mean by that is we have buses in Boston, and we have 22 different start times in the city of Boston.
Yeah.
So trying to get that under control and trying to get, you know, better bus routes that are more efficient bus routes. So when people look and see a bus down the street where there's three kids on it, a big long bus, they're like, well, how come it's not full? It's not full in a lot of ways because of our start times.
And some of those kids have to spend like an hour and a half on the bus.
Yeah, you have kids that go from, say, you know, Hyde Park to Brighton. That's a long day for those kids.
I want to get one more call in the last 2 minutes that we have. Aaron's calling from West Roxbury. You're on the air, Aaron.
Hi, I was just wondering about the schools, how the formula is done for who gets into what schools and how we can diversify the schools in our Boston neighborhoods.
What do you mean by diversify the schools? Explain that to me.
So in West Roxbury, there are several schools that are, you know, very white, and then there are other schools that are not, and it seems like the placement formula is very secretive. So I'm just wondering how it happens and what we can do. I know you're just talking about kids spending too long on the bus, but just wondering.
Are you talking about kids in West Roxbury that live in West Roxbury that go to West Roxbury schools?
So my children live in West Roxbury, but we're not put into a West Roxbury school. But then there are other schools in West Roxbury that are, you know, it's very competitive to get into a school in the neighborhood, but then some of the schools are not diversified. And I'm just wondering what we can do and what the formula is that puts kids in different areas.
Well, I don't understand the diversity piece you're talking about, because 87% of the kids in the school department are kids of color.
Well, I think she's talking about
in West Roxbury, but you also have.
But she said like some schools had many more white kids than other schools in West Roxbury. Aaron was saying.
Yeah, but you have the population in West Roxbury is predominantly white. I mean, so I think that's how that chooses. If you talk about neighborhood schools, you know, what we're working towards is having neighborhood schools throughout the city of Boston. I mean, some neighborhood schools, depending on where you are, there are good, strong grammar schools in all over the city of Boston. And I think that a lot of parents would prefer to send their kid to a school that's in their neighborhood if they have a one within walking distance than putting their kid on a bus.
Yeah.
That's part of our Build PPS plan. And there's a formula when it comes to being accepted to
a
school.
Got about 15 seconds.
There's a formula. Aaron, you know it probably better than I do. You pick the rankings of where you want to go, put your kids into school and what the demand is. And if there's seats available, they're able to place them there.
Mayor Walsh, this has been a good hour. I'd love to do it again sometime soon.
Thank you.
Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, remember everyone, Election Day is just 3 weeks away. Tomorrow we'll be hearing from City Councilor Tito Jackson. He's the mayor's opponent in this very important mayoral race, so stay tuned for that tomorrow at 3 o'clock. But for now, that's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.